Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back on the show today Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Krista Clinic, and he's on the program every month. It's always a Thursday at 10. We have built these programs into the schedule to give you a regular opportunity to talk with a pediatrician. The idea is whatever kind of questions you have about your children, your grandkids, your nieces, nephews, whatever, the kids in your life, can be about some illness problem, can be behavioral, developmental, whatever is on your mind, anything that you could think of talking about with a pediatrician, well, you can pick up the phone and you can talk with the doctor. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. And that number is 800-222-9455. So any point here, you got a question, you can give us a call. Thank you for being here once again.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
We have a caller ready to go. So let's talk with them. In Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I've got a quick question. I have a daughter who's just turning 12, and her skin's starting to break out. And I would normally go to the store and buy the usual stuff, but she has extremely dry skin, and she tends to break out in rashes for no good reason at the drop of a hat. And I'm wondering, what do you do for a kid in this condition?
Yeah, you're in trouble. Because I think what you do is you try the... What kind of breakout does she have?
Well,
mainly little blackheads, whiteheads?
Little white bumps all over.
Little white bumps. I think, you know what, first I think I'd try soap and water. I think there's no substitute for cleanliness, and the soap does help. What kind of soap? Any kind of soap.
She uses Cetaphil, so it's the mildest stuff there is. That's what we've always used.
Yeah. Probably the next thing you want to try for, this is what we call comedonal type of acne. The next thing you do is go to one of the vitamin A, the retin-A's would be the next choice, and that's prescription only.
Oh.
The problem with all of these products is they tend to be drying agents. They tend to be desquamating agents.
And that's what worried me, because they're so dry to begin with.
So what I do with her is go with the lowest potency I can, and they've come out with some new versions of retin-A that are supposed to be less of retinoic acid that are supposed to be less irritating, but all these things are going to be irritants to the skin, so you go with the lowest potency possible, and you do it once a day, and then you move up to twice a day, and you cross your fingers and you hope and pray that the skin will tolerate it. But they're all the acne agents tend to be drying, tend to be irritating to a certain extent, and tend to be desquamating or peeling agents to a certain extent.
And this stuff is only available by prescription?
The retinoic acids, yes. I don't think they're over-the-counter yet. The benzoyl peroxides, the oxys, are available over-the-counter. You can certainly try those, although they tend to work better on the pustular kinds of acne, the red zits.
But
you could try that, but that tends to not work as well on the comedonal type of acne. The bad news I have for you is that her skin is very sensitive and tender, so it's going to be a little bit, the treatment's going to be maybe more irritating than she can stand. The other bad news I have is the comedonal acne tends to not treat as well. The good news I have is the comedonal acne, the blackheads, whiteheads, don't tend to leave scars.
Oh.
And I think that's the what do I ultimately look for in acne treatment? I want this child's skin, when they're not children anymore, when they're adults, to be clear.
Yeah.
To not be pocked, to not be scarred. And so the good news is the comedonal acne causes some tears to be shed, but generally doesn't cause any bad things to happen to the skin in the long haul.
So I should take her into the pediatrician. If what I need is only by prescription, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Let's go to someone else here. This is Southern Illinois. It's line number four. Hello.
How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to offer something that I use. I have oily skin on my legs, and in humidity, they break out a lot. And any kind of abrasions on my skin, I just put vinegar on it. It burns, but it works. on everything I've ever broken out on my skin. It's excellent. So I just thought I'd suggest that to the first caller because, it's fairly cheap. It stinks and burns. I do that before I take a shower.
Yeah, you smell like a pickle afterwards.
Yeah. I'll sit there for about 10 minutes in the bathroom, and then I'll jump in the shower and wash it off, and it clears it up within a couple of days. And I just keep doing it every couple of days. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
I think that might be a little harsh for the face.
Yeah,
but I guess
that'd be, I don't think she'd like that very well. I suppose it vinegar being an acid probably does have a antibacterial, you know, antiseptic type of effect, and certainly we use that. We certainly use vinegar's acetic acid. We certainly use that to treat warts, so it'll cause some desquamation of the skin too. And I suppose it might work on acne, but it doesn't. I don't think a teenage girl would like going to school with the fragrance of vinegar on her.
There was a time when we thought that. That diet had something to do with tendency toward acne, and particularly I think in teenagers. And so we sort of said, well, maybe there were some things that you should try to stay away from. Do we now think that really has any bearing on whether you have acne or not?
No, we don't. Yeah, go and enjoy your chocolate shakes. Go and enjoy your pizza. The only thing you shouldn't probably do is be the hamburger fryer or the hot dog fryer. Yeah, you probably don't want a job at one of the fast food type of restaurants because those people have trouble with their acne. There's something about the fat coming off the grill. But we think that acne is age or hormones, I guess, if you will, and the bacterial bacteria going on with it. And the first line of treatment is cleanliness. And try and keep your hands off your face. Don't lean on your face. Wash your face to try and keep the oils down that way. And keep the pores open and keep it clean. And no digital manipulation, no pimple popping, because what happens then is you spread the bacteria and the lipids, the fatty acids, so you increase the inflammatory response and you just make this little red bump a bigger red bump.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, that also there we have used, and maybe still there is still some use of antibiotics, oral antibiotics. And although now we're also really concerned about overuse of antibiotics, so maybe some people would say that's not a serious enough condition to warrant everything else that you may get because you're giving a lot of tetracycline or something like that. But are there still cases that where you might think that would be appropriate?
Oh, absolutely. I think, again, if our goal is to keep them from scarring ultimately, for these kids with the big cystic acne, the tetracyclines, minocycline is the one most commonly used, are certainly indicated and helpful. And by and large, these are antibiotics that they're sort of dispensable. They aren't vital antibiotics for our health, for the treatment of pneumonia or anything like that. So they're sort of dispensable that way, and so they're pretty safe to use. And we're using low dose, usually once a day, and works pretty well.
Another caller here. The person here is in Champaign, on line one. Hello.
Hi, doctor. My daughter is 12 years old and just had her first menstrual period. Question came up in the first, and we had done a lot of preparation discussion ahead of time, so she was very comfortable, understood what was happening. Question came up whether or not she could use inserted Tampax. And the discussion came, well, let's, in this first month or two, let's just understand how your body works and what's happening and deal with some of that. Question becomes whether or not down the road in the next few months there's any reason to avoid using that, or should we stick with the napkin? And at 12, is that an issue?
I think the problem with using a tampon at that age is the girls find it extremely uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so they prefer to use a mini pad or a pad.
So for a period of time, just stick with that?
Yeah.
But it's really just...
It's a question of comfort, yes.
Okay, there's no health reason or...
Maybe. in the sense of the toxic shock syndrome, although I think they've changed the tampons mm-hmm. now too. But I think what tampon used to be safe as far as toxic shock syndrome is concerned, the tampon should be changed, you know, at least once a day.
Yes.
You know,
I
think that's pretty, I don't think you can, not being a female, but I don't understand how they can leave a tampon in for a day or two anyway. They aren't that absorbent.
Yes. Then the question becomes, in the beginning, is it extremely infrequent? I mean, I don't know how this, I don't remember
okay.
back.
Okay. This may be her, she may not have a period for 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
Or she may have one next month regularly.
Right.
The first 18 months or so, the periods can be very irregular, very unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I get worried about is if they're too frequent. If they're infrequent, that you say, hey, that goes with the territory.
Yeah.
The other rule of thumb is the first 18 months or so, the periods are anovulatory. No egg is released with mm-hmm. the period. So no menstrual cramps.
Okay.
So those are the two rules of thumb I can give you. Yeah, they may be very irregular, and they probably will be unassociated with any cramping for the next 12 to 18 months or so.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bojek. He's a pediatrician at Christie Clinic. He's been with us for quite a few years now, doing this show every month, always on a Thursday. So whatever questions you have that have to do with children's health, anything you can think of talking about with a pediatrician, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Just before we got started, you were just chatting about how you had been doing some reading lately on osteoporosis and the... I think we know that it certainly is an issue, particularly it's an issue for postmenopausal women, although it can be an issue for men. Men can get it too. And one of the primary things we're thinking about is making sure that people, both men and women, get adequate calcium, women particularly. And so now I think we're telling people, look at your diet. Make sure that you're getting enough calcium. Best way to do it, of course, is by eating healthy foods that have calcium, but it's also possible to supplement it. And does that now lead us to pay more attention to how much calcium children are getting?
Yes. And this article had a table that I forgot, but I think it's recommending like 1,300 milligrams a day for the adolescent. And I think that's where we're really concerned about the adolescent female tends to be the poorest eater of any gender or age group. And I think particularly as women are getting into sports, that's good. But that's bad because a lot of them now are worried about low-fat diet, which may eliminate dairy products, which is a great source of calcium. And keeping their weight down for whatever reason, so they're dieting and they may have a deficient diet in a variety of things, including calcium. And so the exercise itself is good. The stress tends to make bones build, but if they're trying to build but they don't have adequate calcium to build with, that's not good. So they're talking about, gee, we do see mineral density variation in kids' bones, although I think we're still, it's a very complicated subject, and I think we don't really know that if we increase the, it seems a good idea to increase the calcium intake of teenagers and keep calcium intakes adequate at all ages, but we really don't know if we can prevent osteoporosis. It seems to be just a real complicated situation. It has to do with gender. It has to do with race. It's less commonly seen in African Americans than in Caucasians. Why do men will get it, but it tends to be much later in life, and that seems to have to do with we men have a bigger bone mass by design, by evolution or whatever, and our hormonal levels tend to stay higher longer later in life than they do in women. But involves virtually every hormone in the body, the parathyroid gland, the thyroid gland, through both the thyroid hormone and thyrocalcitonin and growth hormone, and it's just really a complicated situation, and I don't. Yeah, I think we should do our best to encourage good diet, encourage good activity, because I said earlier that exercise does encourage bone growth and bone mass increase in that. But I think, like you said earlier, it's, you know, it's sort of a healthy lifestyle sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Good diet, good activities. And I think we're seeing maybe more of this bone mineral density increase, just as we're seeing more diabetes in kids. And it probably has to do with our sedentary lifestyle, too much TV watching. Diabetes seems to be on the increase, a kind of a type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes in adolescents. We're seeing maybe more bone mineral density changes. We're seeing earlier puberty, too, and that seems to be related to weight, possibly. Or we've known for a long time that the obese girl hits puberty earlier than the non-obese girl. For boys, I think we have puberty in boys is a little less noticeable, so I don't think we have quite as good a date in boys. I don't think it's been looked at in boys as much, but we certainly are seeing earlier puberty. And just looking at an article that's saying, gee, it's not unusual to see breast budding in a 7-year-old, where a few years ago, that was precocious puberty. They got a full-scale workup to see if they had a pituitary gland tumor, and now it's sort of accepted. But it's a problem because that, again, as far as osteoporosis is concerned, maybe those kids need to go up to the 1,300 milligrams of calcium a day sooner than the kid who's not pubertal. And, yeah, I think it's a big mess yet and quite unclear. And so I think the best we can do is, yeah, healthy lifestyle, healthy eating styles, and concentrate on normal weight and not being too, yeah, not one extreme or the other.
Yeah. Well, we're looking for your questions here. This is our monthly program on children's health with Dr. Robert Bochak from Christie Clinic. And if you have a question, you can call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And then there's that toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. And the call's free. That's 800-222-9455.
No yelling about the flu shot again. I think I don't know what's out there now. Winter was, I think, winter was early as far as temperature is concerned. Winter was late as far as illness is concerned. But boy, we sure seem to be smack dab in the middle of it now. Everybody's coughing and wheezing and febrile, and I'm hearing about 30% and 40% absentee rates in some of our schools around here. So
it finally arrived.
It arrived. So next year, get your flu shots. What can you do now? Fluids, rest, something for the fever. What do we want to do about the fever? We want to make the patient more. We want to make the person more comfortable. It's not a question of battling the fever before it makes the kid's brain melt and run out their ear, because that's not going to happen. In fact, fever is probably important. And I think, what can we do to prevent it? Again, hand washing, use of Kleenex, and hand washing and disposable of Kleenex appropriately, and wait until March or April.
It'll go away again.
Spring.
I think in recent years we've come to understand that maybe one of the reasons that some people really get moody and have a lot of depression during the wintertime has to do with the fact that it's cloudy and we don't get sun, and we need that. It affects our health and affects our mood. So we even have a name for this called seasonal affective disorder, or for people who get depressed. Generally, and it happens in the wintertime because it's cloudy and there's not sun. Do kids get this? Do we see changes in their mood in the wintertime, and we think that that's somehow related to the same issue?
You know, I haven't read any published literature about that, although I don't get the psychiatric literature. But I sure, you know, I think we see a lot more kids, we see the complaint of fatigue. You know, I just don't feel good. Maybe some physical complaints, but mostly it's sort of a nonspecific, I just don't feel good. And I'm just tired all the time. Well, how are your grades? Well, they haven't declined at all. Well, have you dropped off the basketball team or anything like that? Well, no, I haven't changed anything at all. But I just don't feel as good as I think I should. And I sure don't feel good on, you know, I feel much better when the sun's out and
the
birds are singing.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I guess, should we dignify this with a big name, or should we just say, you know, winters in Central Illinois are kind of crummy? And you tend to feel kind of blah when the weather's kind of blah too. And I'm not sure that this needs to be dignified with a big name, unless the symptoms are so severe that they are interfering with, you know, grades are beginning to go down, or you can't go to work, or you're not functioning well. Then I think maybe some therapy ought to be involved. But outside of that, I think if things are going along pretty well, you say, well, April's coming. Maybe March will be sunny.
We can have faith.
We can have faith.
Sandy Mason was here the other day, and I was talking about the fact that, you know, the climatologists, when they talk about the seasons, they like to divide them in nice, even 3-month packages. So as far as they're concerned, winter is December, January, and February. And spring starts on March 1st. Yeah. So we got 2 weeks. We can say if we can hold on for 2 weeks, then we can declare it spring on the 1st of March, and then we can get on with our lives.
Except you and I have been in Illinois
I know, long enough to know that this is we're kidding ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
March and February kind of blur together.
We're here at the midpoint. Again, questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe for a second it might be worth returning to the topic of diabetes, just because, as you say, there's been a lot of concern, more and more concern about that in this respect, that there are these two kinds of diabetes. There has generally been the one kind that is the kind that if kids are going to get it, that's the one that they get. And so we actually can have children who have to have insulin. That's the type one. Then there's this other type, that the type two, that seems to be the one that adults get, and they tend to get it later in life. And we think that, among other things, that indeed has to do with obesity, with being overweight. And the concern now is that, well, there's sort of one concern that generally we think the population is getting fatter, which is not good. But also we're starting to see in younger people the type 2 diabetes that used to come later. And I guess I'm thinking about if in kids, if they were going to have a type 2, how would you know? What sort of symptoms would there be?
With type 1, you obviously know, because they have a voracious thirst, voracious appetite. They're going to the bathroom all the time. They're losing weight. With the type 2s, you don't know, because they often won't have these symptoms. In fact, they're markedly overweight. They certainly aren't losing weight. So probably what you need to do with these kids is probably a blood test, which doesn't go over very well with them. The other problem you've got is the treatment, again, is going to be dietary. It's going to be life habit changing, which they're sort of resistant to. And the other problem with this new type 2 diabetes, or the adolescent type 2 diabetes, it's kind of a type 1B sort of, because these kids can get into trouble with ketoacidosis and that sort of stuff. So it behaves somewhat like type 1 and somewhat like type 2. The other thing about this one is, for some reason, it likes to strike the dark-skinned individual. The African-Americans, the Hispanics, tend to get it more than the Caucasians, and I don't think that's known why, because we know that Caucasians are getting just as sedentary and obese as any other race is concerned. And so it's sort of a new entity that we're seeing. So, again, parents, you know, raise your children well, keep them active, limit TV watching for this reason, for violence reasons, and for all the other reasons with TV. Maybe limit their internet time too, and their game playing time on the computer, because that's probably no healthier than TV to a great extent. And gee, sometimes I have to talk to parents whose kids just like to read and talk about, you know, gosh, I don't know exactly how to say this, but I think you need to kind of encourage your child to put the book down and get out on their bicycle with a bike helmet on their head, of course.
Yeah, of course. All right. We have a caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I heard static through the one. I'm not a child, not at 73, but I can't find how much vitamin D. Do I need it 73, and does my husband need it? He hates the four things that have vitamin D, and he's not supposed to go in the sun, particularly because of his medications.
Okay.
So where does he get his vitamin D?
biggest source of vitamin D is milk.
Which he hates.
Okay. Then probably the next best source is a vitamin.
Okay.
And I think I get one of the senior vitamins. I'm not, you know, I don't remember the exact, general rule is 400 international units of vitamin D, but I think, again, I'm a pediatrician, I don't know about this, but I think in adults it comes down, I think it's a little lower dose, but I'm not sure. And I think if you get one of the vitamins that are made for us senior citizens, it will have the right, correct dose on there.
Right. Well, those, unfortunately, have way too much A. They're still at 5,000 IUs for A. But I got a bottle of D all by itself.
Okay.
It was really expensive, but it's there. And I just want to know if I was missing something, if it was like in maybe cabbage or something that they don't mention.
No. You know, again, that's a sunshine vitamin, and
right.
He's not supposed to be out in the sun for, a variety of reasons. One of them is his medication. The other one is sun exposure is probably bad. It causes skin aging. And the other thing it does is it causes
melanoma.
Melanoma may have, probably has something
okay,
to do
with it.
Okay,
so I'm on the right track with the pill.
Yes.
Okay.
I think we have no other choice.
And he needs the D because he, in order to keep his calcium being taken in, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. D helps with calcium absorption and helps with bone growth and that sort of stuff.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome. The other thing is there is vitamin D is one of the vitamins that you can overdose with, too. If you take too much vitamin D over a long period of time, you can turn your kidneys to bone. You can calcify your kidneys, and that's not good when they calcify.
Other questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for the local folks here. But anyone listening to us around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, you can use the toll-free line. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and the toll-free 800-222-WILL.
We've sure put a lot of names on a lot of things that maybe in my old age, I think are natural things. I mean, if you look at the DSM-4, you can probably label yourself with at least four mental health illnesses. And not only that, this book will suggest what medications you should be on to help make you feel better. And I think, I guess, again, what my philosophy with parents is, as long as your child is functioning well, playing with friends, interested in life, grades have not declined and that sort of stuff, some of these symptoms, I think, can just be kind of observed and put off, and not every symptom needs a medication.
Mm. Well, I hear you. I also think about the fact that it seems that we are hearing more and more about psychiatric disorders in children, and the fact that they're there, and that they're growing. Now, you also have to wonder, well, is that just because, you know, it's as if we've just discovered them? And when that happens sometimes, then, as you say, we start seeing them everywhere. I mean, do you think that you have seen many kids with a genuine psychiatric disorder?
Yes, I think as a society we're driving our kids nuts. I think this is not scientific. This is my bias. What we're doing is, I think kids don't have access to extended families as much. Families are spread all over the place. Children are in daycares at an earlier age. I think our educational system has, in many cases, unreasonable expectations of kids. Reading readiness is expected at kindergarten. At kindergarten entry, and I think there's fairly good data suggest that particularly in boys, reading readiness is maybe not attained till first or second grade, and so we're suggesting that these kids, there's something wrong with them. They must have attention deficit disorder or something because they can't read, and that may not be true. I think we've got a bunch of single-parent families out there with the divorce rate where it is, and I think we're letting television raise our kids a lot. We're not spending time with as families at the dinner table. Everybody grab a fast food as you can. And I think our society is not doing what it can to support and nurture the growing, developing child.
Well, again, other questions are welcome. If you'd like to pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our guest here is Dr. Robert Bocek. He is on this program every month. It's always a Thursday, and we built these shows into the schedule to give you a predictable, regular opportunity to talk with a pediatrician about your kids or the kids in your life. So if you have a question, you can call us again, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. And also toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
I think the other thing that's been in the news recently is the breakthroughs in the treatment of attention deficit disorder, the brand-new drugs out there. There are no brand-new drugs out there. They're just variations in the delivery system of dexedrine and methylphenidate. So they may be worth a try. The advantages of the new medications out there is that they are said to sustain release better. So a morning dose of the new medications is more likely to have an all-day-long effect rather than an up-and-down effect that you'll see with the intermittent doses of methylphenidate or dexedrine.
Hmm. We have a caller here. This would be somebody on line number one, and they are in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning, doctor. I have a 7.5-month-old, and she's been exclusively nursed. She will not take any baby food. I've tried cereals. I've tried the stage ones, some of the stage twos. Is there anything I could do to get her to eat something other than nursing?
Wait. She will do it. We see this not all that infrequently in the breastfed baby, that they like to breastfeed. And and you offer them solid foods, any variety of solid foods, and they just don't seem to get interested. And what usually happens with these kids is they suddenly turn on. And so she may very well go another month or so and skip the baby foods, go on to table foods.
Okay, should I, what do you recommend that I start her with the table foods? Because I'm worried about her choking.
Okay, then you start with the baby food like table food, like mashed potatoes.
Okay.
Fork mashed green beans, cooked carrots and that sort of stuff.
Just real super
Yeah. Scrambled eggs. Now, some people out there are going to say, boy, what you're doing is you're introducing her to highly allergenic foods. And I guess so the next question I have to ask is, what is the food allergy status in your household, in you and your husband?
Directly with my husband and me, fine, nothing.
Okay.
My sister's children, highly, highly allergic. She seems to be taking the breast milk fine. My 3-year-old also breastfed but took the baby foods okay. He has absolutely no allergies.
Okay.
He's okay.
Yeah, then this one will probably be okay too. But you do have a little bit more risk that way. These kids that go to table foods because you can't control the introduction of foods.
Okay.
The other thing you might want to talk to your pediatrician. There's some concern that these kids may need vitamin K doses every 3 months or so, an extra dose of vitamin K, and you might also consider a vitamin supplement with iron or an iron supplement because...
the rickets?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Cereal is probably the number one source. Okay, breast milk babies tend not to get iron deficient, although breast milk, if you analyze it, is not a particularly good source of iron, but it's got 100%, virtually 100% bioavailability.
Okay.
But by 4 months or so, they've outgrown the iron stores that they got transplacentally, and they can't drink enough breast milk to get enough iron, and she's not on cereal yet, so it might be that a supplementary vitamin D source, a supplementary iron source be added too. And often these kids, I might suggest an infant vitamin with iron.
Like the Polysol.
Yeah, Polyvisol with iron.
And then kind of in conjunction, one last question. She's getting up usually twice a night to nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And my 3-year-old at this point was just sleeping through, but he also had, you know, he was eating more of the cereals and all that. I just figure she's getting up because she's still hungry. Is that the case, in your opinion? Or should we start trying to wean her off of those nighttime feedings? Because I would love to get some sleep.
Yeah. I have a great problem advising people to wean off nighttime feedings because these kids won't be weaned. They cry and cry and cry and cry until you give up.
Mm-hmm.
So my general advice with the baby who still gets up for nighttime nursing or even a nighttime bottle is, hey, do what you have to do to get this child back to sleep as soon as possible.
Okay.
So get up and nurse and no talking, no chatting, no smiling, no contact other than breast and mouth. Get her tummy filled up again. And, yeah, probably it's because it may be that she's used to it. You know, that it's kind of habit for her, that she just wakes up and uses the breast to solace herself back to sleep. And it may very well be diet, that she's not sating herself with solid food. So she's got a more rapid gastric emptying, and so she honestly is hungry.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate all your help.
You're welcome.
All right. Again, thank you. And we got time for some to talk with some other people. If you have questions, you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Dr. Rob Bocek. The number here is 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. I know we've talked about vitamin supplements for kids before, and I've talked about the fact that, generally speaking, your feeling was if they're getting a good diet, then additional supplement, you got to wonder whether that's really going to do any good. Is that still the advice, or are there particular things that there might be some reason to seek out some supplements?
Yeah, no, I think except in specific certain instances, like this baby who's solely breastfed up till 7 months, vitamin supplementation is might be indicated there. Certainly kids with malabsorption, cystic fibrosis, or something like that, vitamin supplementation is probably a benefit. But the average healthy child, we do not recommend vitamin supplementation or iron supplementation, or we feel that they should and do out of their diet get all the nutrients and vitamins they need.
Okay. We have someone else to talk with here. Again, on our line number one, and they're in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have suffered most of my adult life with chronic depression, and for the last 10 years I've been on and off depressants, although the doctor has recommended now that I stay on it. My concern, I have a 10-year-old son, and I was wondering I'm worried that he will suffer from the same types of problems, and I'm wondering what do you look for in terms of what behaviors indicate that maybe we ought to be looking at a depression problem, and what age does this typically occur?
Okay. It can probably occur at any age, and I think, again, what we're looking for is how well is this child functioning? Do they seem happy? Do they seem interested in their surroundings? Do they seem interested in friends and going out and riding at age 10, riding their bike with friends? How are their grades?
Mm-hmm.
Just mainly, are they enjoying life? Are they eating well? Are they sleeping well? Are they waking up well? And do they seem to get joy out of life?
Okay. If it's a child who's always tended, I mean, he has ever since he was, born really, tended to be able to entertain himself and to be very willing to forego interacting with other children.
Okay.
Although when he does, he's happy about it.
Yes.
But he doesn't seek it out like a lot of children do. And that seems to be part of his basic personality. Does that indicate that there's maybe a predisposition to it, or is that just the way he is?
I think that's probably just the way he is. And I guess that again, is one of the signs of, is this a change from their usual way of functioning?
Right. So it's yeah. Okay.
So it sounds like he's perfectly fine. Yes, we do have evidence that some of the manic depressive disorders in that appear to be genetic.
Okay.
So I think there's cause to keep an eye open.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, and thank you. And again, if you want to give us a call and talk with Dr. Bocek, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
Well, we've done some unusual topics this morning.
I guess we're sort of...
Seasonal affective disorders out there.
Well, you know how it is when you're a talk show host. You just, you know, think of whatever wacky thing pops into your mind. That's what you ask. Nothing, I suppose, new in the vaccine front?
No.
Nothing like that?
No. I think the only thing now is what seems to be hitting the journals is the meningococcal vaccine. Should we or should we not? There's some disparity between what the college physician group, they recommended, the Academy of Pediatrics, and universal immunization of kids mainly going to college against meningococcus. The interesting thing is, where do we see outbreaks of meningococcus? It tends to be freshman year of college and those kids who live in the dorms. So I think the colleges ought to learn from what the military learned a long time ago. Military vaccinates their recruits, but they also kind of spread out the space between bunks and alternated foot to head and that sort of stuff. And I think our dorm rooms are, they're a little tight, to say the least, and we probably need to give the kids a little bit more room and it would cut down the spread. The other thing, I think the latest article I read said, I think there's like 16 period, not 16 with any zeros after it, meningococcal deaths a year in the college age group in the United States. There's more than that total, but I think there's about 16. So you folks who have kids in college, don't want you to get too alarmed about it. I mean, yeah, it can happen, but it's relatively low on the list. My feeling about the vaccine is it's there, it's available. You may have it if you want. But it's a kind of a funny vaccine. It probably has a short effectiveness, maybe only 3 years or so. And if you give them a booster, you may reduce the effectiveness, which is sort of paradoxical. You reduce the effectiveness instead of increasing it. So there's problems with this vaccine still. And we're hoping for a protein conjugate vaccine in the future that may be more effective, but it's still kind of, gosh, there's some hitches and glitches in this, and it doesn't seem that every, in the Academy of Pediatrics position and the CDC's position, it doesn't seem that every kid going to college should have the vaccine. So it depends on your anxiety level as parents, and maybe the living conditions, how tight the living conditions are for your college-entering freshman. So I guess I don't have an answer.
I seem to remember, I think it was when you were here last time, someone actually called in and said, I have this child that's going to be going to college, to the U of I, and you know, we've heard every once in a while, you hear these stories about outbreaks, and I think she was asking, well, should I have my child vaccinated? And I think that was basically the same answer that, well, you know, we see these things in places where people are crowded closely together. That's why you see them in military barracks and you see them in college campuses, not only places where people crowd themselves together in the dormitory, but they crowd themselves together socially. So that's the conditions are right, but that it may be that it's something that you could get at by looking at them. What are the conditions that support the transmission and trying to deal with that rather than give the vaccination, even though vaccination is available?
And yeah, so I think I will stick with my advice of probably don't need it, but if there's one case on campus, tell your kid to be first in line the next morning at the health service to get their vaccination.
Yeah. Do people often use as a benchmark going off to college and think, well, is this a time for a doctor visit, just kind of check out what your health is and see what your immunization status is? And you know, we do, when little kids go to school, we do. But I don't know if as you get later, there's any sort of idea that says, well, you know, maybe that's when you're 17 or 18. Maybe that's not such a bad idea if you haven't been there for a few years to sort of check in.
I think very few colleges or universities seem to more of them are requiring a physical. Used to be in the past, very few required a physical. Almost all of them now are requiring certification of immunizations.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them now are requiring or a lot of them are requiring tuberculosis skin testing, which I really don't understand. Because, yes, tuberculosis is increasing, and no, it's not increasing, or it's increasing in the high-risk population, but in the average population, still very low. And the Academy of Pediatrics does no longer recommends universal tuberculosis testing. But if your child's going off to college, read that their form carefully. If they're required a TB test, then it's going to take kind of two visits, if you will, one to apply it and one 2 or 3 days later to read it. The second one to read is going to be a brief visit because it's probably in all likelihood negative, but really probably ought to be read by somebody who knows what they're doing with it because it can be kind of subtle sometimes. But I enjoy the pre-college visits because I guess maybe I enjoy talking too much, but it's just kind of fun to get together with the kids again, see where they're off to, see what they're up to, see what their dreams or desires are. Again, checking them out physically is probably the least important part of it. And they're probably healthy, probably won't find anything, but to just see where they're at, see how their emotional health is doing and see what kind of circumstances they're going to put themselves into. It's just maybe it's more fun for me than it is for them. Yeah. Maybe it's more interesting for me than for them. But it's I think it's a good visit.
Well, I would think that around that time, that would be when they would be making the transition away from the pediatrician to a physician, that an internist or a general practice, family practice doctor, somebody like that who's not really the specialist in dealing with younger patients.
I personally don't kick them out at that time or don't suggest that they move. I will keep them as long – I'd like to keep them in my practice or will keep them in my practice as long as they're dependents, as long as they're tax deductible. If you're married, you have a full-time job, you're out on your own, yeah, I think it's time to establish with a physician who will be your physician for a while. But if you're in college – the Academy again says we should see them up till their 21st birthday. If they're in college, you know, I may see them once in the summer when they get cut on their summer job, or once over Christmas vacation, holiday vacation when they get strep throat or something like that. But I'm not going to see them very often, and it's kind of sometimes difficult to get in with an internist, you know, to establish as a new patient. And I just think it's most convenient to stay with your pediatrician through your bachelor's degree. I won't keep you through your PhD, you know, but as long as you're a dependent, I'll be glad to see
all
you.
All right. Well, we're glad to see you. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
Dr. Bochuk will be back again next month. He is a pediatrician at Christie Clinic.